Entrepreneur State of Africa est un podcast produit par Totem Factory by Totem Experience.
Shalom.
Salam.
Shalom.
Allez! Your salut had a very Spanish accent that I loved. Even though your name looks French. Did you ever try to speak French?
Yeah, when I was younger, I mm-hmm. spent a year in Switzerland in the French-speaking part.
Okay.
And so I did. The problem is I didn't speak it ever again. And and when I got to Spain, mm-hmm. What ended up happening is I started learning Spanish.
Oh.
And every time I tried to speak French, Spanish came out. So I sort of abandoned it. But my younger brothers in London, actually went, they speak fluent French. They went to the lycée.
They went to the lycée? Oh.
So my brothers all speak French and I...
You're the only one that doesn't.
Yeah.
But Glover is in so many countries that I think that mm-hmm. he doesn't really need French. English is okay.
English is okay.
Mm-hmm. I think for those who don't really know, they just see maybe Glover as a, I don't know, local startup. I don't know.
Exactly.
Maybe we can drop some numbers. Vanity metrics.
No, true or not true. In fact, Africa is already over 10% of our business.
Wow.
Okay.
So,
really?
Yep. And Morocco, French-speaking Morocco, as we all know,
yeah.
Is one of our top markets at an order level. So,
nice.
You know, we're already doing millions of orders a month in Morocco.
Nice.
And so, you know, French is very important for us and growing.
Yeah.
We know.
But yeah. Globally, what represents Glovo today in terms of numbers?
So we're doing around sales on the platform. So the way Glovo works is we have the sales on the platform, which is generally local stores, restaurants.
Yeah.
They sell through Glovo, some big chains as well, as you know. And we're doing around a run rate of around 4 billion euros a year.
Four billion euros. With a B. So yeah. Okay. Milliard, hein, pour ceux yeah. qui parlent pas français.
Euros. And euros.
Yeah.
Euros, not CFAs, so, euros.
So how does our business model work?
Yeah.
We have three sources of income. We have, yeah. We charge all our partners, the stores and restaurants, a commission.
Yes.
Depending on the segment, it's less or more.
Okay.
For example, high margin, restaurants generally have a higher margin than, let's say, electronics.
Okay.
Electronics have very small margins, so we take a percentage, a small percentage of a commission on every sale.
Sure.
And we also charge a delivery fee to the user.
Okay, yeah.
So that depends on various factors. Distance is one of the most important.
Yeah.
You know, if it's further away, we charge a little bit more. Also, the commission rate, we charge less commission to store, we might charge the user a little bit more delivery fee.
Sure.
So that's our second source of income. And more recently, over the last 2 or 3 years, we've been building an advertising business.
Oh.
So this allows
okay.
local stores and restaurants to actually raise their awareness.
Mm.
So the same they would use Google Ads to promote themselves, give discounts,
sure.
sometimes offer free delivery. If they want to promote themselves, they can use Glovo
oh.
as a tool to promote themselves. And sometimes we'll work with them as well. So we'll actually pay some of those promotions ourselves from Glovo.
Okay.
So it's a mix.
Okay, so you support that yeah. advertising.
So it's three income streams we have. Advertising is more recent.
Okay.
Our main two have always been, you know, charging commission for sales and, mm-hmm. and a delivery fee to the end customer.
And how many countries today?
We're in 26 countries.
26 countries in all the continents?
We're not in all the continents. We left Latin America 3 years ago. We sold our business there.
Okay.
So we had a very, very good business there, and we decided to leave and focus that growth on Central Eastern Europe, Poland, the Balkan regions. Mm. We're also in Central Asia, a group of ex-Soviet Union countries, Georgia, Armenia, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan.
Oh, you're there.
Yeah, Ukraine. Ukraine's a very big market for us.
Oh, still now to this day?
Well, when the war started, we actually left, we closed everything down because we were obviously worried for the team and everything. But actually, the couriers asked us to reopen.
They need
the team income. Asked us to reopen. The government then asked us to reopen as an essential service.
Wow. Okay.
So it's a very important market for us.
Okay.
We've also, you know, we have a lot of fundraising activities to help Ukraine as well. And more recently, of course, Africa. We're 7 countries in Africa.
7 countries?
Yep.
So we have Kenya, Côte d'Ivoire.
We have, first of all, Côte d'Ivoire.
First of all. Yeah. Merci bien, merci.
We have, so starting North Africa, we have Morocco, Tunisia, Côte d'Ivoire. We have Kenya. We have Nigeria. We have Ghana and Uganda.
Okay, okay, yes. You're in Ghana too.
So yeah, it's west and east, not south, yeah. And a bit of north.
So far.
Okay.
So it was just to give some context, but what we like in our podcast is also to give people a perspective about the human behind the business. Mm. So for us, it will be interesting to know, like a few years before founding Glovo, how would you introduce you to someone? Who were you before?
Myself.
Who were you before? Yeah.
It's good. My kids ask me that. What do you do, Dad? And I say, well, I go to meetings and send emails.
Just that, all day.
I started my first company when I was 25, and it was in technology. It was tech. The online world was just starting.
So it was a page company, something I understood.
Yeah, it was a tech company. We'd build websites for other companies.
Okay.
And we started off that, and then I spun off a digital agency as well. So we built a digital agency which did more advertising, more creative stuff.
Okay. So that's what our dear Kai here is doing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
And then towards the late 90s, which was the first phase of the internet, seems a long time ago, we set up what was then a portal services business, which is very similar to maybe what Google might be today.
Oh,
but Google didn't exist then. So it was a Yahoo. I don't know if any of you remember Yahoo.
Hasta Vista, they were...
Alta Vista was a search engine.
They're all dead.
So there was a lot of search engines. But we had a free email, we had a search engine, we had home pages, we had classifieds. We had about 10, 12 different services, all in Spanish. Okay. And it was the largest Spanish-speaking community in the world.
Mm. Okay, so that was like your third company.
Yeah, it was a spin-off of the company I was building, but absolutely.
So it was a spin-off a spin-off?
Yeah. Well, what I had a partner who came to me who was building a free email service.
Yeah.
And he was really enthusiastic, and he asked me, can I build it for him? Because I had the tech company. Okay. And I really liked his idea, and I said, well, this has huge opportunity, let's do it together.
Nice.
And so we set that up, and this was the late 90s. It was very successful, especially in Latin America. It grew incredible. We launched out of Barcelona.
So you started in Spain?
Yeah.
And the product grew through the Spanish diaspora?
The way across Latin America. In fact, we had in the late 90s, we had 12 million active users.
12 Whoa. Million?
Which was huge then. Now it's not so much.
12 million? It's still... Yeah. Still.
And we ended up selling that to our main competitor, which is a US company called Star Media.
What was the name of the... Yeah.
Which year you sold?
This was May 1999 we sold.
Okay, so in 99 you already sold
one company.
It was the, at the time, it was the largest exit of a Spanish company.
Okay. Okay.
And it wasn't very much then. It was a lot then, but it's not now. It was $18
million.
$18 million. Yeah.
Exactly. Some people raise that now.
In a Series A.
Exactly, as a Series A. But
And we sold that to our competitor company called Star Media, who actually was our competitor, a New York-based company.
Wait, how does that happen? How do you sell to a competitor? I imagine they...
Well, we were fundraising, and we were trying to fundraise in the US. Okay. And they heard we were fundraising. They were going public. They went public on the NASDAQ. Mm. And we didn't know at the time, after the sale, they told us why. Because they said, what's going to happen is... First of all, we had more traffic than them. So they had about 4 million active users.
And you had 12?
Yeah.
Wow.
But the market was going to value them, maybe 800 million or 900 million, right?
That's so based on what then?
Then that was the first that was the first internet bubble.
Yeah. 20.
Based on 2000,
it was.
Based on the wind blowing.
Exactly.
So they told us afterwards why they acquired it. They said what was going to happen is when we go public and the market values us at, 700, 800 million or whatever, the next day they're going to value you, not maybe more than that because our revenue wasn't as high as theirs, but we had more users than them. We were going to value us at a lot more.
Mm.
So they quickly took us out as a competitor out of the market who could have been well-funded.
Yes, they wanted to avoid you guys catching the spotlight once they raised and went to IPO.
Yeah, because they were, and at the time, Star Media, this is a funny story as well, they received pre-IPO, $90 million, which at the time was the largest pre-IPO amount of cash input for any company in the history of the US.
In the US even? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
So we're talking the late 90s, so things have moved on quite
exactly, but it's impressive.
Yeah, yeah. So they were a big internet high flyer. They were going to be the Yahoo of Latin America.
Mm.
And, you know, the US were really bullish on them.
Interesting.
Okay, but what, like when you are in the 90s, like there's not that many people like today went into startup, digital. Like what made you think that this is where you want to go?
That's a tough one. So first of all, I used to, my first career from 16 to 21 was, I was a racehorse jockey.
Oh, you were a jockey, yeah.
Yeah, I used to race horses.
On horses.
Very popular in England, France, the US. Not too popular in Spain, not too popular.
You went to race jockey to startup founder.
I was racing the UK, then I
was in the UK when you
were. And then I went to the US for a year.
Okay.
And I stopped by Barcelona just to, my mother was living there.
Okay.
And I fell in love with the city. And I said, what am I going to do here? And luckily, pure luck, I decided to learn to program, computer program. Mm. So I gave up racing and learned computer program.
By yourself?
Yep. So I did an online course. No, I did, there was...
There was a course, I mean, but no classes. You didn't take a diploma, what most people do.
Well, there was a diploma, but it wasn't a university. I was in a rush. I didn't want to study for 4 years.
That's the main thing.
Yeah, yeah. So I quickly learned to program. I got a job. And then very quickly, this thing called what we all know now is mainstream, but then it was the internet came
along.
The
internet, yeah.
Mm. And I remember finding email. And I was like super enthusiastic, and I'd be going to dinner with friends and saying, "Have you seen email?"
Really? Yeah.
And they would say, "What's that?" And I'd have to explain, "Well, you can receive things, and you know, it's like a fax but digital."
And no one cared with Facebook.
And I was like, "Yeah, this guy's a bit of a nutter."
Really? People didn't care at the time.
And I was, and that's when I really became a tech evangelist a little bit. Like, just realized, wow, technology can just close the borders of communication, And I decided, you know, that the internet came out, it was a great thing. So I set up a company and luckily it went quite well. And I got started.
You know, luckily is something I tend to, when I hear, to get a bit interested. But like, if you were to look at yourself back then, what set you apart from most people, except your curiosity for the internet? Was there something else that, in terms of self-awareness, what made you decide?
Yeah, because you just said, like when you were with your friends, you were talking about email, they say, what are you talking about?
Yeah.
Why were you different?
One thing I've had, I think I'm quite advantageous, is the fact that I didn't have any pressure.
So I
came to Barcelona. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't have a university degree.
Yeah.
So I didn't even really have an education. I left home at 16 to race horses.
Oh, mm-hmm. So you were not in the high school, classical system.
No. So I got to Spain and really, I didn't really have any pressure. My wife, for example, who I met very early on in Spain, is a lawyer.
Wife was a lawyer?
Yeah.
And you met her when?
She was studying law.
Oh.
But what I mean is she had a lot more pressure than me. So she was, society was making her make the right decision. For me, it was very simple. I mean, it was just, I felt like doing this.
Let's do it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't have a great job to give up. I didn't have all this thing. I think sometimes the less baggage you have in life. Mm. And I remember... And this is also the start of my career,
mm-hmm.
and it's probably the best known venture capital fund in the history of tech. It's called Sequoia.
Sequoia, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I remember, and Sequoia were around. They'd invested in Yahoo. They've invested in all these early startups, and today they're still investing. And one of their thesis, and I read this, was very interesting. It says they invest in first and second generation immigrants.
Yes, that's true.
And
yes,
why?
I read that. Yeah.
Why? Mm. Because they have no baggage. They have no... They just have to get on with things.
Yeah.
They don't have anything... You know, they have to.
They have to make
survive,
things happen.
To survive.
Exactly.
Mm.
Yeah.
And I felt, when I read that, and this was around the 90s, the late 90s, I said, wow, I'm actually going on the right way. Because, as I said, I arrived to Spain without very much, without much, you know, no job prospects,
yes.
No education.
And your mom was
lucky.
Yeah. But wasn't she worried? You know, African moms would be very worried.
Well, you got to remember, I'd already been working for 5 years by myself. I'd left home at 16 to race.
Oh, okay.
So I didn't go to Spain and live at home again. I got
you're at your own place.
Yes, I was already an adult.
Okay, so you were early in all of those things.
Yeah,
not only
quite
in
early.
Tech.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty interesting.
What did you learn as a joker that can be useful as an entrepreneur?
Hello, moi c'est Marina.
Moi c'est Cora.
Kamkara.
Moi c'est Manouche.
Je m'appelle Lindsay Mabé.
Je m'appelle Sylvie Audouin.
Je fais partie de la tribu Entrepreneur State of Africa. J'ai rejoint la tribu avant tout pour soutenir le podcast parce que je trouve que c'est un podcast de qualité. Kayi et Moulay font un travail extraordinaire avec leurs différents invités pour nous apprendre, pour nous faire grandir. Et je trouve que c'est génial. Également parce que j'avais envie de rejoindre une communauté de personnes qui ont envie d'apprendre, qui ont soif de réussir et qui ont envie de se développer, tout ça dans la bonne humeur. Donc si ça te parle, n'hésite pas à nous rejoindre sur Telegram.
Quand je rentrais dans la tribu, j'étais arrivé à un moment donné où il restait juste un peu, j'allais abandonner parce que je n'arrivais pas à développer mon business. Et quand j'ai contacté M. Kayi pour lui l'informer de la situation, il m'a juste donné 30 minutes. Et je peux vous dire, mon business aujourd'hui a fait de 64 fois. On a multiplié par 64.
Probably discipline. I think professional sports, you need to be very disciplined.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Maybe I think horse racing is for the horse is the athlete. The jockey has to be in shape, but it's not like a 100 meter runner or it's the horse. It's often patience.
Okay.
For example, you maybe sat on the best horse. Mm-hmm. But you have to wait for a gap to open. If you become impatient and pull the way around, you lose a lot of space. So it's, I think, patience, discipline, teamwork. You know, there's a trainer, there's a jockey, there's people who train the horses.
And maybe competitiveness.
But I think that's in genes, I think.
Oh, really?
I'm super competitive.
But you were always competitive.
Yeah,
interesting.
I don't know if
so
that's
you
bad,
will you will
I'm...
talk about Jumia later on, but later. But it's important for us to ask that because you know a lot of people are dreaming about becoming entrepreneurs, and they think that when they are entrepreneurs, they will be more disciplined, they will be more patient, they will be more And the thing we want to highlight is that is the way you are now. We will determine who you will be when you will be an entrepreneur. So that's why it's important to not just say, oh, you were in your joker, but you see? Yeah. That's really important for us. And maybe you wanted to add something.
You felt a difference on that part. On when you started entrepreneurship, from what I listened about you seem to be the kind of entrepreneurs that people came to. You said the people came to you to propose the email opportunity, and then some of us came. Do you feel like this discipline and these passions was something people saw in you?
I think early on, I don't think people come to you. I think you have to earn that. So I built a small tech company, but when this person wanted to build a free email platform, came to see me, it's because somebody recommended you should go and speak to Sasha. He's got a good tech team.
It's a reputation.
He's probably a good guy. He's probably ethical. I don't know. There's a lot of things. I don't know how the people describe. So I think you have to earn that respect.
You earn the respect. That's very true.
And I think there's a lot of ways of earning. You can be very good. You can maybe be very easy to work with. maybe you can be very humble.
Awesome.
Maybe it could be a lot of things. But I think you have to earn that at the beginning. But once that begins happening, then generally you'll find a lot of people who recommend you. I think... The great thing I've had, one of the things I look back and is pretty much anyone I've worked with in the past has always wanted to work with me again.
Oh, that's a very good indicator.
And me also, I've had so many people who've worked with me, both by my side, but also in my teams, who've gone on to build companies. And that is amazing.
Yeah.
That makes me feel super proud that I, I've helped them. They've helped themselves, obviously. Founders are not built because somebody, but if I've instigated in any way that, makes me super proud.
Wow, very
interesting. So, before talking about the basis of Glovo, because you say you sold your first company in 1999.
Mm-hmm. So how old were you?
Yeah, no, during this period, like between 1999 and the founding of Glovo, what happened? Did you start other companies? Mm-hmm. Did you fail also?
So Star Media had a famous, quite a funny story. So I sold Latin Red to them in 1999. They received a lot of funding, so they went public on the NASDAQ. A big round of financing went that. They also did another round while they were public. So So they were received a lot of capital, but they were really burning a lot of money, cash. A lot of investment, not a revenue stream. And in the end, they end up being sold to Orange.
Orange, the group.
Yeah, so they weren't called Orange then, they were called France Telecom.
France Telecom bought them. Oh, interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Bought the internet business. And I was then, for Star Media, were literally going out of business. Mm-hmm. They were, and based in New York. So I ended up becoming CTO.
Oh, you were CTO then?
And I was running their internet business. They had a mobile business, they had an internet business. And Orange bought the internet business. And my team in Spain, we had about 60 programmers, ended joining
Orange.
Well, they've rebranded since then to Orange. They had a portal business called Wanadu. I don't know if you remember.
Wanadu, yes. Wow.
Yeah. Remember? Flash from the past.
Yeah, I love it.
And end up integrating there. So they completely closed down the US business.
Okay.
And my Spanish tech team ended up running their service portals for their Spanish business in Spain and Latin America.
Wow.
Okay.
And well, I was there for a couple of years. It was pretty good, but I wanted to do something else. And a company called Betfair gave me a call. I don't know, which is online gaming. Today it's called Flutter. They're a publicly traded company as well.
We went
public. I joined them and I ended up working with them 9 years, and it was an amazing experience.
9 years, okay. Yeah. Okay.
And when you said they called you, same thing, may I ask?
Sorry?
How did they call you? Like someone recommended you again?
No, I think so. What they probably thought is sports betting. So I come from the horse racing.
Oh, so you know the sports.
And a tech sort of entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And they were probably looking to expand their business into Europe and especially Spain. They said, hey, somebody said you should speak to Sasha. And I was a big fan. Betfair was a unique company as well because they built a peer-to-peer betting platform, which is users betting against other users, which was very unique at the time.
Yeah, people were betting against each other, which was not the case before.
Yeah, yeah. So they're a very, very innovative company. And it was a great, I mean, I learned a lot there. I met some really interesting people. I met our future chairman at Glovo was the person who hired me at Betfair.
Wait, sorry, what? Can you repeat that?
Our future chairman in Glovo. So we brought a chairman on.
In Glovo now?
Since we sold to Delivery Hero, he's no longer there. But but he helped us really expand the business. But he ended up expanding Uber's business internationally. So after Betfair, he went on to do a few initiatives. But he basically built the first phase of Uber's international expansion.
Okay.
He's super important person, and he ended up leaving Uber, and I gave him a call because he's a really good friend of mine. I said, hey, do you mind helping Glovo expand? And he said, okay.
You said, people enjoyed working with you enough to, but he was the one that hired you at Betfair.
Yep.
Wow.
He was my boss. Yeah, yeah.
So you hired your boss.
You hired your ex-boss.
Yeah, yeah. That was I'll send him this clip.
Exactly. Just send him this clip of saying,
he was absolutely fundamental in how we built the playbook to expand internationally. You know, we're just in Southern Europe. We were doing quite well, but actually to build that playbook and how to replicate it. In the end, we're 25 countries, but you know, we've been in close to 40 countries at any given time of Glovo, and we've expanded. So to have that and experience and have learned from mistakes in a fast growing company, which is a reference, I think, for a lot of people is like Uber, is amazing.
Mm.
Wow.
But it's quite rare that someone starts as an entrepreneur, then go back to
being an employee.
For more than a lot of years.
Yeah. First of all, I was a big fan of what Betfair were doing. It's very early on, by the way, in Betfair's story.
So you came before they were IPOing?
So it was quite early on. I really liked what they were doing. And I remember saying to my wife, hey, I think I'm going to join Betfair. I think I'll probably be there a couple of years, but it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm going to learn a lot as well. Because I was, instead of being building product technology or receiving advertising, because in Latin Red, our business model was
advertising.
I was selling advertising. And it was the other way around. I was investing in marketing. building. So I'd never been that side of the business. And I thought to be the commercial side of the business and to be building market, I'd learn a lot. So to me, it was, I thought I'd be there, have some fun, learn quite a bit about that. And in the end, I ended up staying there 9 years, and it was an amazing experience. I met a lot of talented people. It's super high growth, a lot of competition as well.
Awesome. So you were enjoying the competition.
Yeah. I mean, we did a lot of big sponsorship deals as well. I sponsored Football Club Barcelona for three years.
Barcelona.
Did a lot of things I hadn't done before. And to me, it was super, super good learning.
So you moved from the CTO to marketing role?
Well, it was a GM CEO role.
GM CEO role,
But more growth focused.
Mm. Okay.
That's interesting. You seem to have a lot of self-awareness, like you know who you are. That's what strikes me, because for someone to go as an entrepreneur and then to go, oh, I will go to Betfair as an employee because I love their vision, I love the atmosphere, I love the culture, it means that you know what is good for you. But most of the time what we see is people, I was an entrepreneur, I cannot
go down
because people will say, oh, he failed, that he's an employee now. So I think it's really important to highlight that, to know yourself and to follow what's important for you rather than what's important for the others.
Yeah, I think I'm more than know myself. I know I'm very well aware of what I'm not very good at.
Which is a good skill.
And there's a lot of those things. We need another podcast to talk of things.
Really?
Yeah.
You can share a little snippet.
What I'm very good at is I'm very good at surrounding myself with a good team. I've done that since day one.
That's true. Yeah.
You know, I'm very good at, I think, at identifying people and working with them, and I think I'm very good at finding good people. I don't know how. I think it's a lot of intuition.
That was our question.
Our next question is, how do you do that?
I think everyone here has the question, but HR, how do you surround yourself with
your team? And I'll go back. And the other one is, I've always, maybe that's from upbringing and everything, but I've always just decided I want to do things that I want to do, like that they look like they're going to be fun. For me, it's very important to enjoy what I'm doing. You know, I don't know who said it, but it's like, don't get yourself a job, get yourself a hobby. And for me, it's never been about, you know, going to work for money or even the success stories. I know startups now, and if they're an exit, the success, unfortunately or fortunately, is you know what you make for your investors and what you make. But actually, it's more about the success of the project, right? And having an impact, and you know, being able to build a company with tens, hundreds, maybe thousands of people.
Yeah.
I mean, that's worth more than, you know, a big payout. So I don't know. I think it's always been about enjoying what I'm doing and learning. I think that's lucky, and that's probably my upbringing. I don't know why, but it's just sort of happened.
You never felt like the pressure of making money?
No. As going back to the beginning of the podcast, you know, I've never really had a pressure to succeed or do anything.
Interesting.
So, and did you fail in a entrepreneur project?
Yeah. I remember. So when we sold Latin Red, me and my partner, we thought, wow, we're really good at this.
We amazing.
Let's do 10 of these. and so we set up a almost like a venture builder. It wasn't called that then, but now they're called startup studios or venture builders. But then we thought, let's find some CEOs and let's do this idea and let's do this idea. And we did four or five of those. They all failed absolutely miserably.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And the rationale is, we came to the conclusion, why were we successful? It's focus. But not 180% focus. You know, you can't do three. First of all, it's super difficult to have a success story anyway, even if you're a rock star.
Yeah.
And so if it's super difficult to have a success story, if you're not focused 180%, you're not going to do it. Yeah. There's no magic. There's no magic sauce here about, you know. And then I just realized, you know, and the ideas were good. They weren't stupid ideas. And the people we hired to launch those businesses were super talented people. But at the end, it's about focus. It's about focusing 180% on your project. You're going to have so many moments, difficult moments. You know, Glovo, same. I mean, we really nearly ran out of money 3 times.
But oh, literally, interesting. You actually ran out of money?
Yeah.
Like, I mean, all of us?
Fundraising was super difficult.
No, it's important for the audience.
No. Fundraising was super difficult for us because we were a small Spanish company competing on the world stage with huge massive companies. You know, we were competing against Delivery Hero, a public company, Uber. Deliveroo had received a lot of money in the UK. So big et cetera of company. You know, Jumia in Africa is a public company.
Yeah.
So we were competing with a lot of big competitors, much bigger than us. And investors and VCs were saying, can this small Spanish company compete with a lot less resources than these big companies? And they were quite right to question that because it is difficult. And we are a cash intensive business. We're high, you know, we need high volumes and we have small margins. But fundraising was super, super difficult for us.
Mm. Interesting. And so when you think about the times when it was hard and like, how did you manage? I think your co-founder was Oscar.
Yeah. Yep.
How did you manage together, you know, to, I don't know, not crack, not give up, not just scream at your employees? I don't know. How did you manage to?
The crisis.
Yeah. The pressure and the mental health aspect of it, because I feel like you mentioned discipline, but I think it doesn't help necessarily in the stress that we have to feel when you're facing death right in the eyes most of the time.
Yeah, I mean, it's persistence, no? Persistence, focus. Yeah. There's a lot of things. I mean, that's why, you know, generally it's good, you know, to have another co-founder, maybe two. You can help each other through the difficult moments.
Oh, that helped to have someone to talk to.
Of course. Mm. It helps not just to talk to, but I mean, Oscar's an amazing founder. Mm-hmm. One of the best guys I've ever worked with. He's young, but you know, Glovo would not be here if it wasn't down to him. But you need talented people around you there's difficult moments in startups, and those who are building one and those who are a bit ahead and already in a scale up phase have know that there's a lot of difficult moments. I mean, it's not just finance, it's team. You have key members leaving, you have competition coming.
Also, your family need to support.
Yeah, and it's hard work, and you dedicate a lot of hours. Mm. So it's a lot of moving parts. Mm. So yeah.
But so coming to Glovo, what was the vision at the beginning for Glovo? What was the vision?
I think the vision's changed. Our vision is to give everyone easy access to anything in their city.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the big differences about Glovo and all our competitors is all our competitors jumped on, you know, making restaurant food very accessible with a great customer experience. Mm. So you had a nice app, the menus. Mm. And when we started Glovo, we were thinking much more about all stores and restaurants. Mm. So you could literally order anything from your city and we would deliver that. What quickly happened, of course, is many of our customers were ordering a lot of restaurant foods, especially from restaurants who weren't online. Okay. So those top local heroes. Here in Abidjan, there's a few, but those restaurants that we know here that are your favorite restaurants that are online now, you know, 6 years ago, they weren't online. They would just walk in. And they were scared of being online because that would damage their brand as well.
Yes.
Oh, bad experience. I don't want that.
I don't want the food to be cold when it arrives. It might not be good.
So we had our customers ordering from those restaurants, going there, ordering. And I remember one of our first big partners in Barcelona called us and said, I've got all these Glovers coming to my restaurant. What do you guys do?
Mm. Because initially you didn't tell them that you were Glovers. Not. You were just people ordering.
Yeah. Well, I called them, but they were saying, no, I don't want to
talk
to you.
Oh, so when they said no, you...
Yeah, customers would order from there anyway. So
wait a second.
No, that's important.
That's such a... So basically you're telling us that when Glovo started, when you tried to get a partner, if they were not interested to sell directly through you, you were just ordering as an individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's how our customers started with the best restaurants initially in Barcelona, where we launched, then Madrid. And
that's interesting.
Yeah, version one of Glovo didn't have any restaurants in the app at all. People just order from anywhere they wanted in the city, and we'd bring it to them.
That's the first version was just getting someone to buy something for you.
Exactly.
Doesn't matter where.
So what happened was obviously all the best restaurants or local heroes, we call them local heroes, are these top smaller restaurants that have the best products. Mm-hmm. Customers would start ordering there. And then restaurants would start to see the amount of orders that were coming there.
And so then, the same guy, did you wear already at the time the Glovo yellow?
Yeah, yeah. So we Glovo yellow was probably about the second year. That we actually, our first logo we bought for 10 euros on the internet. And it was an hot air balloon. You can check in the old logos. But we thought we better actually build our own logo because this logo is probably around there a lot.
Somewhere.
Somewhere.
So actually, a good friend of mine did our branding. And I think 2017. 2016, actually. Yeah,
so this first day, this first moment. So you start to get traction, at least to try to have traction before funds, or start with funds.
So what we realized in the beginning is that if we tried to agree with a lot of stores and restaurants, you need a big sales team to do that.
That's the main point.
You need to convince people.
Yeah.
Imagine a sales going to your store or restaurant and saying, "Hi, we're Glovo. Do you want to be in our app?" They'll say, "I don't know who Glovo is.
Yes.
Why do I want to be in your app? Come on, I'm going to pay you a commission."
Yeah, commission is not going to fly.
So what we did is we decided to create traction.
First.
Yeah. Mm. And I think that was a big, big positive decision in our case, because if we tried to build the marketplace, which is what Glovo is today at the beginning.
Yeah.
We would have used a lot of resources. I think we would have slowed us down a lot and wouldn't made it so magical. And we built that traction. And then what we created in Glovo 2.0, which is about a year later, is restaurants wanted to be on our platform because they could see our couriers in the city. They wanted to be part of that. Who's this company?
Oh, okay.
No? And they realized that we had user base and we were going to give them incremental sales. And then they started joining us, and then other restaurants would see, "Oh, this my competitor's on Glovo. I want to be there." And that's how.
Okay, so that's how you started the flywheel, basically.
But the first year you didn't invest that much in the tech, in the app.
We didn't invest much because we didn't have very much money. So
okay,
so that's the first reason. So we early on we invested very little in tech and very little or zero in marketing.
Wow. Okay.
So growth was organic. What we did very well is at a small scale, because that it's not going to build massive business, but it does create awareness. Is a lot of PR press really love the story of an app.
Oh, press like the story? Okay.
Yeah, they love the story, because imagine you have an app that you can order anything in your city, and journalists would say, "Well, I've always wanted that." It's a very simple concept, isn't it? And we've always wanted that. No, I mean now Glovo exists, but before that, imagine having in your smartphone. Your city here, and you can just order anything. It was a nice concept. So the press loved that in the beginning, and it gave us organic growth traction. We didn't have money to invest in marketing. We built a small tech team, but it really wasn't. You know, we didn't have the capital to do that until we started doing a few of the later rounds. We could start building a solid tech team.
So this is the time where
we're very bootstrapped the first year.
I'm very interesting, because you already had the experience before of creating a company that sold. You probably, once you started working, you had maybe a bit of cash, but even today, if you were to start a company, you would recommend doing that much effort on traction, less marketing and less tech?
Different companies and different sectors types. Are different. I mean, we started Glovo with 140,000 euros.
140,000.
140,000, we started Glovo. Nice. We literally launched the first version of app 2 months after that. So this was March 2015. Mm-hmm. We didn't call it an MVP then.
Yeah.
But looking back, it was an MVP.
It was an MVP for sure.
Because we had to rebuild everything. The tech was not very solid, but time to market was important. So we got out there very quickly. Started creating traction, starting getting excitement.
Okay.
You know, what's this company? I see the yellow. They weren't yellow then, but the boxes on the street, I can see Glovo.
So you started initially just with people around you, basically, when you said press of the idea of and, you had and, a few yeah. years and then
we launched in Barcelona. 4 months later, we launched in Madrid. And then a year later, we were already in Italy and a couple of other cities. So we expanded very quickly.
But from the beginning, you knew that you will go out of Spain.
Yeah, we were very ambitious. Yeah, that's one thing we coincided in, that we didn't we didn't want to just build a Spanish company. We thought we could build something quite big, or we wanted to.
And that's interesting. Why? Like, it's, Spain is a fairly good market. Why initially you thought we need to do globally?
We thought, and I think quite rightly, that the problem is if you just build a local business, bigger companies will come and they can just invest a lot of money very easily. You know, they can subsidize orders. And so you not only have to build a business that you protect what you've got, but also show investors that you have ambition.
Yeah.
That an investor, if he's going to invest in you, will actually have a company that's going to initially play on the European scale, but then worldwide. So it's also, as I said earlier, we're a very capital intense business. Our competitors had a lot of capital.
So you knew you had to go out there.
And it's not only expansion and that, it's also protecting your business, so you have enough resources to defend your own markets.
But the competition was already hard at that time.
Yeah, it happened very quickly. I mean, to be honest, it did. Deliveroo was based in the UK, but they quickly expanded in Europe, and they came to Spain with a lot of capital. They were investing in advertising and you know.
So how do you resist?
Good operations, knowing the market better.
I like the concept of the local heroes you talk about.
Yeah, I mean,
that's a very key concept for Glovo, I think.
Yeah, and then focus. I mean, you know, we were, I honestly think we were more focused than our competitors, who were just had more capital than us. But we really had ownership. I think the team, not just the founders, but the team really felt ownership of the company, that we were really, you know, David against Goliath.
And you felt this urge to fight.
Well, that's hugely powerful, right? If you can get that and transmit that to your team, that you actually, and this competitiveness, and how we'd have to do more.
Do more with less.
Yeah. And you know, that just shows just passion, you know, beats everything.
But you need to tell us, because before talking about your first turning point where you raised maybe your first round, because you say before, the skill you have is to surround yourself with good team. I think to resist to the competition, to convince people to bootstrap, you need to have a good team. You need to have a strong team who believe in your vision. So can you give us some tips about how you select people you work with?
Est-ce qu'on ne crée pas un petit suspense?
Si vous êtes face à cette vidéo, c'est peut-être que vous êtes un créateur de contenu.
Bonjour à tous, je m'appelle Nader Fakri.
Vos outils favoris sont les mots.
Bien d'autres avant moi ont déploré ma terre et ses mots.
Les images, les vidéos et les illustrations. Vos ingrédients sont l'humour, le suspense, le romantisme et le glamour. Certains tendent même à vous appeler
influenceurs,
créateurs de contenu,
des influenceurs, des
influenceurs, influenceurs.
Quel honneur!
Ou encore, si vous regardez cette vidéo, c'est peut-être que vous êtes un professionnel de la communication. Vous êtes curieux, enthousiaste et surtout animé par une féroce envie de construire une belle communauté et de l'animer de la façon la plus efficace possible pour la visibilité de votre marque. Il est possible, si vous regardez cette vidéo, que vous avez déjà participé à l'un des événements de la communauté Africa Digital Communication, Adicom pour les intimes, Adicom Academy, Adicom Watch et surtout Adicom Days, le plus grand rendez-vous annuel des acteurs de la créativité digitale en Afrique.
How to recruit?
Well, I think first of all is our values, our core values in the company have not changed hardly anything since the launch. No,
and how do you know that this person has the values that you're looking for?
Well, I mean, it's typical that there are interview questions, but I think it's more about you understand clearly. No, I mean, one of our core values is be humble. No,
and be humble. Oh, that's one of your values.
So I think that's super important. You can easily check that on in an interview. Yeah. It's gas as well. That gas doesn't mean just, you know, working a lot of hours. It means going quickly.
Gas. I don't know this concept.
Gas.
Stamina. To press on the gas, basically.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe it's going quickly ahead of perfection. So maybe it's more aligned to time to market, which everyone, you know.
Okay, yeah.
try things, but rectify very quickly. So don't be afraid of making mistakes, but you know, once you have done, move quickly. So there's a few of those values that you can identify in traits in people.
Can you maybe share one of your best hire? Like someone, like when you think about, like that's something that I always ask entrepreneurs, like what was one of the people when you hired them, you were first sure that they were going to change a lot, and when they arrived, they actually like contributed, or did you have anyone that came to mind when you think about that over the years?
I think there's a few and different moments. He's like a co-founder, but he's like our COO. He actually runs the international business, but which is pretty much the P&L of, and he actually studied with Oscar in the US. And he came over almost working summers because he had another year left in Georgia Tech, and he came over and he was helping us out, and he was even helping us out from the US while he was studying, and he came back, and luckily he wanted to actually work in the US, but we convinced him to stay with us, and I think he's been something who's been fundamental.
So, and how did you recognize in this friend of Oscar this need to have him in your team? I imagine that Oscar had other friends. Like, why this one?
I think it was a lot of things. His drive, his focus, his passion for that. Also, he's super young. We couldn't afford anyone senior.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That's a very good point.
No, I think it's more than that, but the jokes apart. No, but really, I mean, no, what I was going to say is there's other people who've been fundamental, but maybe the timing is good. So, you know, the moment we could hire, you know, people with a little bit of a curriculum, we also had to have a brand by then.
Yeah.
You know, a startup who's received 140,000 euros, you know, you're not going to get somebody with a trajectory.
Yes.
And it's very, why were they going to, unless they know you and they say, I want to work with them, but generally. So there's moments later on, you know, I think our head of, our growth, the person who's built the growth strategy came in. A little bit later, he had a little bit more experience.
Okay.
He'd seen things and done that. And then he could build a playbook, and he knew exactly how we could grow the markets or certainly adjust.
This was someone from the beginning you knew it was going to be a hit.
No, I mean, we hired him assuming he would, and he turned out to be fundamental. You know, there's also, I think the guy who built our product, he came on quite early. So I think there's been a few key people. I don't like to mention any because they've all been fundamental at different moments.
Yeah.
Also, timing is very important. In the beginning, and this would be certainly, I think, is a general advice. And when you're starting, I think you need to be very tactical. So, you know, there's a lot of founders who want to build these massive scalable businesses in day one. But actually, you need to show traction.
Yes.
And you can't build scalable businesses, you know, with three people. You need to get out there, get your, you know, product market fit, show organic growth. And that is often tactical and getting stuff done very quickly.
Yes.
And then once you have that, you can start building in scalable processes in, okay, how am I going to replicate this that worked on a larger scale? But also maybe the professionals you had to do the tactical stuff and not the ones you need to do the scalable stuff.
Amen.
For example, you know, somebody who can manage a three-man team does not necessarily be able to manage a 200-man team or 200-woman team. And I think often skill set is important in the timing of a startup. Some people evolve.
Yeah.
Some people grow and they grow with the business and others don't. And that's absolutely fine. Okay. It's fine. Mm. I mean, but I think the early stage is very much tactical, getting stuff, showing quick growth. But maybe the technology you've built to do that is not what's going to build the business
to the size that you wish.
And maybe a CTO in the beginning is a different from a CTO, you know, 3 years into the company.
Absolutely.
And absolutely nothing wrong with that. I mean, and people should be aware of that as well.
But you yourself, how did you improve over the years? I imagine you had to change your job because I like to say that when you're a CEO, your job description changes pretty much every 2 years or a year if you grow fast enough.
Yeah.
So how did you, like, did you train? Did you take a coach? Did you?
I don't know if I've improved. I mean, it should be others should say that. Honestly, I mean, I'm not super aware of, I think what I do is I adapt to the circumstances and I adapt to the moment. And again, I'm also very, I think I'm, I can identify people in the right moment of when they're right for the job. So I think that's probably my skill. If I've improved or not, I don't know. I've certainly, you know, in a different company now, this is Global's obviously the biggest project of my life. It's, you know, well over 4,000 team, 25 countries, you know. We have close to 100,000 active couriers every month, 180,000 partners. Most of those are small businesses.
Whoa.
Selling on the platform. So it's a huge, but so being part of that is very different than, you know, running part of the international business of a betting company or, or, you know, building a portal business in the 90s.
It was not the same. Yeah.
Yeah, that's
different times,
same.
Different moments, different businesses.
So when you got the traction, so that's when then after that you feel comfortable to see VCs. How does it work? How did it work? Like they came to you or you
came to you?
we never know.
Yeah, no, like,
pardon him. He's not a startup guy. Pardon him.
I've had that question before. Somebody said, can you please tell this entrepreneur how you can choose the right VC? And I'm like, what?
Yeah, you don't.
We were begging VCs. It was like it wasn't choosing is the first one.
Exactly, so you don't choose.
So I think the first when we were in Spain, the first year there was quite a lot of buzz around Glovo. So people, the Spanish ecosystem was talking about us.
Yeah.
And I think that was the easiest time we've had fundraising.
Okay. Our initially.
Yeah. Our series A was, but once we went international because the VCs in Spain are still quite small compared to the rest of Europe, in fact.
Yeah, I think it's the same in Africa. Yeah, yeah. They're pretty limited in the...
if you went to beyond a Series A, you really needed to go to VCs outside of Spain. Mm. And that's when we hit this hurdle of how is this small Spanish company going to compete with Uber?
Mm. Whoa.
You know, I mean, you know, $40 billion company.
And you raised $1 billion in total.
Yes, but this was much later. This was right at the beginning.
They were already like a billion.
I was trying to raise 20 million. So fundraising was super difficult. So we really had to convince. And there was one round where we, you know, we did over 100 visits to VCs all over Europe, also in the world. And we got, you know, we got over 100 no's.
Oh, you got a lot of no's, obviously.
Whoa. No, over 100.
Oh, so over 100 no's.
Yes.
That's the target.
No. And, you know, we're getting close to running out of cash. And luckily, Rakuten came along. And,
Rakuten, Japan.
Yeah. And also Barcelona.
They came to you?
No, through one of our current investors. They reached out. They presented us. They actually liked what we were doing. And they invested. And you know, that was one of the rounds. And later on, we've had other tough rounds. So
despite the buzz, you had 100 no's.
Yeah, because at the end, venture capital is looking to give their investors a return on their investment, a positive one.
Mm.
And we could be doing things amazingly well, but if they don't think we can compete,
yeah, and be and be just as big and do hundreds of millions,
then we could end up dying and be a very bad investment. They could lose their money and then not give a good return to their investors. So at the end of the day, they're there for a reason, and that's why I think, you know, but yet. There's other startups who are generating a lot of buzz, a lot of growth, and they have queues of VCs fighting to get their tickets in. Mm. So it's different. But to be honest, once we were outside of Spain and looking for capital outside of Spain, it's super difficult. Pretty much every round.
Pretty much was round, but I think
no. But every round until our exit to Delivery Hero.
And every time, I think your current investors, when you mention them, seems to be very pivotal in this step.
Yeah, no, we had some very supportive investors who really helped us out. Helped us out in not just fundraising, but also, you know, helping business. With the ideas with business. I think, you know, investors, not all, some bring a lot more value than others, but I think it's good to have good people around you, and talented people and people who have seen things, who know people,
who know people.
Yeah.
That's good.
So at what time did you start to expand in Africa?
I think we launched Morocco 4.5 years ago.
Okay.
Approx.
Okay.
Maybe close to 5 years ago.
And so you launched South America before?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep.
So could you tell us like maybe what was the main differences or what surprised you when you arrived? I know that Morocco is not the same as Kenya, as Côte d'Ivoire, mm-hmm. but maybe give us what surprised you around those markets.
I think there was some major surprises. What I think, one thing is the essence are the same. So in the sense you need to have a good user experience. Mm-hmm. You need to have the best partners. So it's fundamental for us, maybe in Africa, the biggest difference was the lack of digitalization. Mm-hmm. So I'll give you a good example. You know, we base, you know, our app on location, so Google Maps. Mm-hmm. Most of our restaurants when we launched here weren't even on Google Maps, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Mm. Oh, true.
So they weren't, you know, digital. Yeah. Whereas in Europe, everybody's on Google Maps, and so I think it was maybe digitalization was a little step behind. I think that's going very quickly now.
Yeah.
But generally the essence. We're very similar. I mean, you need a great user experience. You need the best partners. So customers want to see their favorite restaurants or the best restaurants and stores. Obviously, logistics is a nightmare.
Yes, that's the.
I was
point.
Delivering yesterday, and you know.
Oh yes, you
crazy.
Mentioned that. Yeah, yes. That you did
I don't
delivery.
Know if someone ordered Glovo yesterday, but Sasha was delivering in Abidjan.
Yeah. Yeah. I've been to Abidjan 3 times, and every time I've delivered. So
you're always.
Yeah, delivering. I try and deliver when I go to countries. I think it's a good experience. I take some knowledge back as well to headquarters.
So you talk with the customers.
Yeah, I talk to the customers. I talk to the Glovers. The Glovers are the most important to talk to. The couriers.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, they have so much information. They know what works, what doesn't. They have all the pain points. And
you say the policemen are looking at yours.
Yeah, I think they were surprised. So white guy was doing a delivery. I don't know. He was looking. They were looking at me in a very and I was just smiling, and then they'd smile back. It was cool. They were thinking, "What's going on here?" The customer was even more shocked.
They give you some tips.
Uh-huh. Give us some tips.
Yeah.
They gave you a good tip.
They gave it. Yeah, but I was doing the delivery with a courier, and he got the tip.
I think it's time for us to take questions now.
Yep.
Yeah. I don't know if you have the mic. Les dames d'abord à Yako. So yeah.
Ouais.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi, sir. Thank you very much for airing your experience and be that transparent. You've explained that being humble is one of the core value of Glovo, and I think that today shows that you really match it. So I just think that it's a very good thing as a CEO, so global like you, to do so. Now, talking about the questions, I actually got two, if that's okay.
Is it please okay? make them quick because the others are there.
I will make them quick. The first one being, do you think that the rise of AI will actually change the way, if it's not already the case, Glovo is running or will run?
Yeah, I think AI is going to change a lot of things. Mm-hmm. I think AI is going to change a lot of things. What maybe... It reminds me a little bit of everyone's talking about AI and mm-hmm. everybody. And if you look at the history of the internet, mm-hmm. as I'm old enough to have seen,
yes.
when we had a search engine and we launched Latin Red, there were literally, and you mentioned Alta Vista,
yeah.
there were literally 30 search engines.
Mm.
They'd all received a lot of money. In those days, which today is not that much, but everyone's thinking, you know, search, everyone's going to be searching all the time. And in the end, none of those companies exist today. Google was the second phase of search.
Mm.
So I think AI is definitely going to change things. It's hugely powerful. Mm-hmm. But maybe ChatGPT or Bard or what we're looking at today
won't be
the winners.
Mm.
And there's a lot of rush of capital as well into AI, which is going to grow. And it's, but I think, you know, maybe some of the big names we're hearing about now, there's a lot that, I have a lot of feeling that the second phase of digital companies are often the ones who've learned and know where things are going a little bit better. But yes, AI is massive and it will change Glovo's and everybody's business. I mean, you know, instead of navigating, you'll be asking, what's the best pizza in my neighborhood? Or I need to buy this. And where can I get that? And Glovo will tell you, no?
That's nice.
Year, you've also explained that since day one, you surrounded yourself with good people that helps you grow. Now, I'm keen to know, what are the things that are keeping you sane along those all of those years?
I think I'm insane.
Fair enough.
No, I think don't. I mean, as I said earlier, I've often felt very little pressure. I'm like, I don't think I'm scared of failure, so I think I'm happy to fail. I'm competitive, so I like, but I think not taking things too seriously at the end of the day, there's, you know, health and, you know, being safe and your family are serious stuff. Building a tech company, it's great, and, you know, but I don't know, I think you need to put things into perspective a little bit. And generally, I remember, and this has been, I mean, you know, when people describe stress, to me, stress is generally accumulating of doing too many things you don't like. No, if you think of when you're stressed, it's generally you've got things you don't want to do, right? It's not having a lot of work. No, I think Leo Messi doesn't have stress and he probably trains, you know, 12 hours a day and he loves it. So, and he plays, you know, sometimes three games a week and I don't think he has stress. So I think doing things you want doesn't give you stress, or as long as you're enjoying it most of the time. So I think that's quite important. Then it's not the question of the amount of hours or no, I mean, it depends how important money is to you. I mean, we need to eat and we need our families. Okay. And we need a roof over our head. No, but generally once you have that, I mean, having two roofs doesn't make you a lot happier. There's a responsibilities. It's not just yourselves,
it's the salaries of your employees,
you know, when you have tens then hundreds, of course it's a massive responsibility. But as long as you know you're doing the maximum you can, as long as you feel that you're doing the maximum, then you feel okay with yourself, because you know there's no guarantees here, right?
Yeah.
And you know, when somebody decides to join Glovo, and especially early on when we were startups, so startups, the most probable thing is, as we all know, they will fail.
Die. Yep.
And so when you join a startup with 10 people or 20 or even 100, there's a high probability this company won't exist in a few years. So people take that risk when they join, and they're conscious of that. But what they will do is they'll come out of this having learned a lot more at a much higher speed and be in a much better position than if they've worked to a nice, safe multinational, having a nice desk and a decent salary. They're going to be in a much better position after that. But there's a high risk that, you know, you might have to look for another job afterwards. So I think as long as the management team, the people are doing the maximum they can, then you feel ethically and you feel good and you can sleep at night.
Yes.
Hi. I hope you're doing well. Thanks for sharing your experience with us. I have two questions.
Okay.
The first one being, do you think that the fact that you have no pressure whatsoever to succeed, like you did not really care much to succeed, do you think it gave you more room to take bigger risks? Were you kind of reckless, you know, in starting your things? Did you just think it was fine because you had no pressure to, as you said, you're probably not coming from something big, you just wanted to do your own thing? That's my first question.
It's a good question. So maybe Oscar had different different pressures, and he felt that different. In my case, mm-hmm. it probably does make you a little bit more reckless. As in, it's probably a fair statement. I think it makes you mm-hmm. more willing to take risks, mm-hmm. which, you know, reckless can seem a negative connotation, but mm-hmm. I think it certainly allows you to take more risks.
Yeah.
Think bigger, mm-hmm. not being scared of, you know, I'd rather go big or go home a little bit, which. But generally, I think as well that there's also a cold-mindedness of making decisions. You can't be euphoric about your successes or down in the dumps about the negative stuff. You have to be very
even
balanced. Yeah. Mm. And I think there's a lot of patient thinking there. And you know, my partner was, you know, and the co-founder was extremely good at that.
Oscar was very,
he's super unbelievable, incredible, like that. Yeah.
Hmm. That brings me to my second question. Do you have a go-to decision-making process? Like, whatever kind of decision you're facing, do you have to, like, a couple of questions you're asking yourself, and then depending on the kind of answers that you have, then you decide to go yes or no?
Early on, we would have that type of process. Now we're a big company. we align objectives. Mm. We use a methodology called OKRs. It's very well known. Yeah. Where your key, you define what are your key things that you want to focus on at a company level. There's probably only 2, 3, 4 of those mm. at a very high level.
Yeah.
One would be maybe giving great user experience. Mm. That could be one, for example. That's a good example. And then we align the business. So any decision we make or any priority, because imagine Glovo can do a billion things tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
In Abidjan, we could be a payments service. We can be anything. You know, we have this app installed in all these smartphones all over the city, and we could go into anything. And it allows you to focus on the key elements. So if one of our, you know, KPIs or OKRs is giving great customer experience, mm. then we can align the technology resources, which they're bottlenecks everywhere, you know. You know, any tech company is probably doing 10% of what they could do. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean if you've got 10 engineers or you've got 10,000 engineers. You know, Amazon is probably doing 10% of what they'd be like to be doing.
yeah. And but you're focusing on the 10%.
But, mm. So what you do is it allows you to focus on key priorities for your business. So I think there's different stages. But I think when you're starting up, you certainly have to make quick decisions, and generally it'll probably be the, you know, the founders, if there's 2, 3, or 4 of them, will decide on what's the priorities. And that's why it's good to surround yourself with good people who also complement you. It's one thing we haven't talked about surrounding yourself with people.
Yeah.
It's super important. You know, you don't want 3 founders exactly the same. No? Diversity is super important. Mm. Diversity, not only in gender or in nationalities or in culture, but diversity is super important in the way people think. You know, mm. introverts with extroverts. Mm. It's very good to have complementary teams, like relationships.
Please, only one question.
Well,
only
I know one. I wouldn't marry myself, I can assure you.
Really?
Only one question, please.
Experience with this. I would like to know if you already aim to implement the new functionality proposed by Google, the VPS visual positioning system, into the next features of Glovo. The principle is a kind of better version of GPS, where it's more, you know, visual, like you just have to use your screen, like 3D and
the augmented reality.
If you know of it, and if there are plans to implement it in the future?
I think short term, no. I think we have other priorities. I mean, I'd rather focus, if our average delivery time is 31 minutes, I'd rather that became 29. I'd rather give my partners, the stores and restaurants we're all ordering, tools so they can run their business better. You know, I think our users, what they want is a great UX here, and it's all about expectations and meeting them. Mm-hmm. So I'd love to tell my users, you know, your order is going to come in 29 minutes and it comes in 29 minutes and they have complete visibility. Whether they can see it augmented or in 3D, I think is maybe a necessity in the future, but I've got other priorities.
Great.
I would like to talk about...
I don't think it's on.
I would like to talk about
We don't hear you. We
need the difficulties. You mentioned the
difficulties. Just for the podcast.
Oh, you need to speak much louder. What you parle plus fort.
You mentioned the difficulties around the fundraising. And you told us that you had around 100 no's. And I wanted to know how did you manage to continue instead of telling yourself maybe if 100 VCs refuse to finance me, maybe they are right, maybe it's not the right project, or maybe there's an issue about my project. So did you know why they refused, and or did you change the project at some point, or did you just continue applying with the same?
Yeah, I think it's just one answer. That A, first fundraising, it's just survival.
Yeah,
I mean it's persistence, survival. As I said before, it's not just not just a bunch of people and this isn't working. By those point, we had hundreds of employees, and so it's about persistence and survival and not getting down in moments when it's being very equilibrium in the sense that, and also when you have successes, don't let it go to your head. So it's not just about the difficult moments, it's when you have a success, you keep your head. So I think it's being very, very stable and rational way of thinking. So I think that's the first thing. There's a second piece of the question which I missed, which...
It's basically how did you add to adapt your speech, your strategy or your execution in the process to try to get a yes?
So I think we adapted Glovo over time and different things, but not necessarily fundraising.
No, you cannot.
It was more about learning, making mistakes, building playbooks. In the end, we're in thousands of cities. So it's not a question of 25 countries, it's thousands of cities where when we launch a city, we've done it many times before, so we've got a playbook so we can replicate. Some countries the playbook we have to adjust, so obviously it's, launching Spain is not the same as Ivory Coast, and Ivory Coast is not the same as Georgia, so we have to adapt it. Some marketing works here in a different way than it works in other countries, but generally we try and build scalable processes in and learn from our mistakes, and that, but it wasn't really based on VCs or venture capital telling us that we had to change the business. No. One thing that we didn't do, which I think we were right, and we were told by venture capital in the beginning, because 90% of our business was restaurants. So we were often told, why are you doing the other stuff? Double down on restaurants, focus. That's what everyone else is doing. But we believed in, and we still do believe in this concept of giving everyone easy access to anything. And then this thing called COVID came along and everyone started ordering groceries online. And Glovo was already doing that. And now all our competitors are getting into the grocery business, but we've been doing it for 8 years. And we've got the tools, thanks to that, that we built.
Yeah.
That gives us an advantage with what we call Q-commerce, which is quick commerce.
Yeah.
Which I think was going to be the fastest growing part of e-commerce in the future.
Yeah.
Jumia knows that very well. And I think we've been doing this for many years, and lucky we kept to our vision. We managed to be in a very good position for offering not just restaurant food, but actually local stores and restaurants. And then, the ideal is our user just gets our app and he has his city in his pocket or in his hand. And that's what we aim for. And we never left that vision.
Demandez-vous quelle équipe de production derrière ce podcast? Hello, moi c'est Odufoua Baudouin Fabrice, monteur cadreur à TX Factory chez Totem Experience. Si vous aimez ce podcast et que vous voulez la même chose, voire même plus, n'hésitez pas à nous contacter. Nous saurions vous donner une touche de créativité à vos projets. Ah, on vient de me demander à la régie. Allez, ciao.
Vas-y, last question.
Le micro. You left your house at 16. So you have survival skill, you have constitution, you have like a kind of good balance in terms of psychology.
That looks very impressive to me, right? So I'm really thrilled, but I'm asking myself, do you come from a family of entrepreneurs? I mean, where did you get all of that?
No, my dad was a musician, and my mother traveled a lot. She did a lot. Maybe my mother a little bit. She's done a lot of things. And she did it alone. So she traveled a lot, doing different things, I suppose. Not really. I was never really driven, but I've always been like that. I mean, I think I started selling popcorn at a market when I was like 11, in the UK, I was doing. We have this thing. I think it still exists, but giving the paper round.
Oh, I was a delivery boy.
Okay, yeah, I was a delivery boy. Same color bags as Global. I wish I had a photo. they were orange.
Same color.
No, a little bit different. But I would love to have a photo. There's no photos of that. I've always been sort of been a hustler. No, in that sense. I think it's definitely in my genes for sure, because I've been feeling that since I was very young. But also again, it's maybe if I'd gone to the best universities, and maybe I might have this pressure to do well, which I haven't had, which I honestly believe is a huge advantage to people if they take it as an advantage, right? Mm. And not say, well, and no. And I think that's why I'm a big fan of, I think immigration is super important, and immigrants are generally driving economies. And if it's not the first, it's the second generation. You can see that. Often it's small businesses early on, but in the end,
they grow. Vas-y, Steven.
C'est bon.
Oui, on t'entend.
C'est pour le podcast.
C'est juste pour le micro qu'on entend. On t'entend un peu. So Steven,
non, mais t'inquiète pas, ça
en fait, juste parle.
Ok, ok.
Ouais, ça suffit.
C'est qu'on a des gens des podiums.
Tranquille.
Non, je rigole. Donc moi, je vais savoir ce qu'il faut retenir. Donc j'ai deux questions à retenir. Et puis un peu, ça va aider pour les vidéos teasing, c'est cadeau.
Cadeau.
Donc la première question, c'est... Alors, c'est vraiment... Bon, tu vas le retraduire après.
Vas-y.
Donc, Elon Musk, divorcé. Jeff Bezos, divorcé. Bill Gates, divorcé. So
please go ahead.
En fait, comment il a pu, lui, avec IPO plus exit, $4 billion, consolider sa vie de famille quand on sait la pression que c'est, et comment sa femme, ses enfants se positionnaient dans tout ça jusqu'à ce qu'il puisse exit? Qu'est-ce qu'il faut vraiment, on a besoin de partage.
Sacha, I think you got this one. You talk about divorce a lot. So I think you got the idea. He was just asking, how did you manage to make sure your couple, your family,
For example, all the Bill
all the
Gates,
Elon Musk, all of the other guys end up.
But how do you know I'm still with the same woman?
Exactly.
You've done research?
No, he's asking. Because you said your wife, you met her earlier.
Yeah, basically,
he said you met her early.
Yeah,
that's why.
Yeah, we're still together.
So. Yeah. Oh, okay. Congrats.
Yeah.
really, that's it.
Yeah.
Like, how do you do? Like, he wants the answer.
30 years, eh?
30 years together. Yeah. Hey, goddamn.
Yeah. I met her when I was two, eh? So, that's a tough one. You better ask her. I mean, it's not easy as well. I mean, it's you know, relationships are difficult. It's also expectations, no? I keep doing a project and I say it's the last one, and then that one's over and I do
another one.
I keep gaining time. But I think it's it's finding the right, I think it's the right person. I don't think it necessarily, just because I managed to do it and I'm, you know, with Star Media, we did an IPO. Betfair did an IPO.
Yeah.
Glovo, we sold Delivery Hero. So those are probably my three big projects. Different decades as well. But yeah, I think it's just, I mean, again, I don't take a lot of stress with me. I work a lot. I work, but I don't, I'm not, you know, I can leave my work behind. So don't take myself very seriously is very important. No, I take serious things important, health. You know,
you don't bring your work at home, basically.
Yes, I do. No, but I don't think I'm necessarily in a bad mood if I've had it.
Okay.
You know what I mean? I think you
compartmentalize.
Yeah, I'm probably too much on emails at home, but I'm not necessarily negativizing things. And yeah,
if there's a bad thing at work, it will not be in a bad mood at home.
I think, but. I don't know. That's a really good question. I should ask the people in the know, my family. They'll probably give you a different answer.
They might give you a different answer. Yeah.
Et deuxième chose qu'il puisse retenir, c'est quel conseil il peut donner à la jeune génération quand on sait aujourd'hui que beaucoup de jeunes se tournent vers les startups et l'entrepreneuriat pour, entre guillemets, devenir riche.
Ah.
Donc, lui, qui a reçu des chèques pas mal, qu'est-ce qui se passe le jour d'après? Et quel conseil il peut donner à la jeunesse, à l'entrepreneur, par rapport à son rapport à l'argent? Parce que certains ont loupé des grandes occasions, grandes opportunités, parce qu'ils n'ont pas voulu laisser les gens entrer dans leur capital, par exemple, tu vois. Donc, c'est vraiment...
Yes.
Comment il faut manager avec ça?
So,
c'est vraiment pour le legacy.
The last question is the legacy you would give, because he said that you receive a lot of checks. I'm not going to comment on that, but he said that basically a lot of people get into entrepreneurship to get rich. And what would be your input back to people that are young about the relationship they should have to money, for example, into getting more people into their company or sharing more compared to what they expect in terms of wealth in the end?
I don't like giving people advice about what motivate. Everyone has, we all have different motivations.
Yes.
And I think, you know, personally, if somebody's motivation is economical, I don't think that's necessarily negative, as long as you're not doing anything negative to achieve that. He's not stepping on people, or he's ethical, or she's ethical about building her company. So to be honest, I don't really like giving advice. I know what motivates me. It hasn't been economical. It's been about building stuff and seeing that and the impact. And to me, my legacy is the amount of, I think, people in Glovo now, and previously I touched on that have built their own companies after working with me.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure the legacy that Glovo leaves, not Sasha, because Glovo is a lot of people, is the amount of entrepreneurs that come out of Glovo. There's already been, I think, close to
20.
There's been over 40 now.
Whoa.
Startups that have been funded by ex-Glovo employees who've received capital. So these are not just ideas on a presentation.
VC, they receive capital.
Investors invest. I think there's one in the audience here.
Yeah.
And and I think if this has happened already, imagine with the thousands and thousands of employees, how many startups will come out. And then that has a massive impact, because these startups, it's not about that. They're also hiring hundreds and thousands of people. I think the legacy will be that'll be the biggest legacy, and also the, you know, hopefully there'll be a few unicorns that come out of that, and I think that'll probably be one of the things. Glovo's been an extremely young company, generally age wise. My Oscar's only 30.
Oscar is only 30?
Yeah.
Oh
yeah.
God.
He's only 2 years older than me, and
he's a machine. That's not like.
I met him when he was 22. Yeah.
He started at 22.
Yeah, but also the company is very young. In the sense that there's still a lot of young people. They're learning a lot of things in a fast moving environment. As I said, over that time we've been able to hire a lot of talented people with experience as well at later on, who can also give guidance. So they're going to come with a lot of tools to build big companies, small companies, yeah, successful companies. So I think that'll be the legacy.
Wow.
Okay.
That's good. Thank you.
One more.
No, he has to go. You want to take one more? You're okay?
No, no, yeah, I'm fine.
You're fine because we know you have a dinner or something afterwards, so we don't know.
We had a dinner, no?
You are there? Okay.
Hey, Lubao Kraga here. Is there...
Can you speak much louder on top of that?
Lubao Kraga here. Thank you. Thank you for sharing your experiences across the globe. My question is there a chance to see you launching a VC fund focused on African startup in the future? Okay. Knowing that based on the latest report from the World Bank, 2/3 of the world population will be in Africa by 2050. Mm-hmm. And based on your own data, since you launched in Africa, mm-hmm, you know, based on your own data, do you think that there's an opportunity to see you with your experience and your
wealth, maybe your money? Like, I think he's trying to not say it, but okay, basically, do you want to invest in
funds.
Us?
Okay.
Simplify this, my friend. Let's go.
So you see, we're running late, right?
Exactly.
No, wait. But this is karma. This is now. I can pitch.
Yeah.
What I wanted to talk about today, which to answer your question quickly, there's a couple of things here. Mm-hmm. With Oscar, we're setting up a fund now. It's called Yellow.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Yellow. You can. We're actually very close to the first closing with investors. We've been. It's a small seed fund. It's focused on this first fund on Southern Europe mainly, mm-hmm, and the rest of Europe, so it's not really focused on Africa. Mm-hmm. There are some investments we can do in other markets, including Africa, but it's not focused here. Mm-hmm. Why Yellow Fund? Basically because between us, we've invested in 40 startups in the last 3 years, just with seed, just almost amateurishly, but it's gone quite well. Some of them are going very well. Okay. So I think it's going to be a profitable investment, and we wanted to professionalize that and scale it. So we've joined an experienced investor who's the other partner. And we're basically going to professionalize and learn what we've been doing, you know, ourselves manually, over the last 3 years. So we're setting that up now. And we're very excited about that. And what that would mean is, you know, we'll see how that goes maybe the next year or so. Mm-hmm. And if we're being successful, and me personally, as those in Global know me, I love Africa. I fell in love with Africa. I come here as often as I can, and I would love to invest here in the future.
Oh,
but again,
come down.
Yeah, but again, to do. But investment is not.
Yeah,
it's not a game, right? It's and if you set up a fund, often you're not doing this alone. You're doing it with others, investors' money, so you have a responsibility there.
Yeah.
So if I did do that, I'd like to do it properly. Mm-hmm. I'd like to do it with a team, with people with knowledge of the region, and do that. But certainly, I love Africa and I love Ivory Coast, of course. But I also love, you know, the neighboring countries, Ghana. I go to Kenya. And we have a big business now growing in Nigeria, Uganda as well. I'm a big fan. Mm-hmm. So I'm a big. And then also what I think there is an opportunity, mm-hmm, and this is easy, is this legacy I talked a little bit earlier, mm-hmm, about how many startups and companies are founded out of Glovo. We do have a project called Glovo House, mm-hmm, within Glovo. And what we realized is these 40 plus companies have been created organically, mm-hmm, by ex Glovo employees. Mm-hmm. No, they leave Glovo and they're entrepreneurs and they want to, we thought, well, actually, there's probably a lot of people in Glovo today, employees, top employees, by the way, mm-hmm, who are going to set up their own company. Mm. And normally companies, what they'll do, especially multinationals, is they'll try and stop talent becoming an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
But we think it's inevitable. If somebody's an entrepreneur, they're going to do it anyway.
Yes.
So why don't we give them the tools while they're still in Glovo to do that? So we set up a project called Glovo House. You can check online. And I think this is also could be inspirational to all our African employees. Mm. Mm. And what we do is we help them with funding. Mm-hmm. access capital. I think there's a, you know, mm-hmm. there's a great venture builder here in this studio here mm-hmm. who does that, you know. So maybe through Glovo House, we can incentivize Glovo employees mm-hmm. work Glovo, here yeah. mm-hmm. And get startups created through our employees in Africa through that project. But it also includes mentoring. It includes access. It includes validation. No, maybe they have an idea, a business model, but actually people in Glovo or people around us can actually improve that. Ah, why don't you focus on this? So it means a lot more than and that. So that's certainly something that can happen tomorrow mm. or mm. today, actually. Mm. And that exists. So
that's great. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you,
thanks
Sasha.
A lot. Thanks a lot for the invitation.
You liked the experience.
Yeah, it was great. Yes. I loved it.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you to the M Studio, to the CI20 for the invitation. And I hope we can continue to have some chit chat around the nice drinks and food. And thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. You can have the video on YouTube.